These old apartments converted into a storage space. Standing here again, knowing it for what it is, I remember Duck's voice from so long ago.
Look at this, Annie. Look at all this finery.
Without Duck, without Lee, I make my way through the finery of what was once Lee's winter home and search for a sealed amphora with the storm scourge crest. They were bestowed, Lee explained today, as he gripped my hand on the rail of the bridge, the words coming stiff and slow. Amphoras of Drakthanasia, when you had a choosing. But my father's was never used at the widowing, because Alethea's execution was saved for the palace day spectacle. The beheading that Lee and I watched together in the People's Square when we were children, a year after Lee's family were killed. Lee's hand seized in mine at the memory, and I squeezed it tightly, remembering that day, how we wept for different reasons and learned why. I find the amphora soft with dust and wipe my thumb across the embossed neck. When we were last here, I couldn't read Dragon Tongue. Now I understand it without conscious thought. Drakthanasia for Extreme Unction. Presented to Leon Sir Alethea, Storm Scourge, upon their choosing. Lee's father received this when he was a child, younger than we are today. The amphora is roughly the size and weight of a full vase with curved handles on both sides. It is, as Lee predicted, still sealed. Dust is thick in my mouth and in my nostrils. Stained light pours in from high windows, glowing on the forgotten grandeur around me. I remember wandering through these piles of old treasure in awe and delight, with Duck's hand in mine. The whisper of the memory, of his smile as he led me on an adventure, leaves my palm tingling.
Isn't it beautiful, Annie?
I felt, giving that cuirass to Cor today, that I was giving up Duck. But standing here, remembering Duck's words, I realize otherwise. If my parents taught me to have courage, Duck taught me to see. To see beauty and to love it. To let myself smile. And in this small way, I will never lose him. Even if, as I did my mother's, I one day forget his face. Duck's a part of me. I think of the way Cor seemed to break apart when I gave him Duck's cuirass today, as if by giving him back a piece of his brother, I had handed him a key that unlocked him. I too have felt that kind of opening, that kind of gift. My fingers rise to the rusted chain of my mother's necklace. I roll it between my fingers, remembering how it felt when we stood before the ruins of my home and Lee gave it to me. As if this little bit of everything that had been taken from me was still mine. But Lee has never had such a thing to hold. I begin a second search, rummaging through every compartment within a 6-foot radius of the amphora until I find a worthy recompense. A Dragon Lord's boot knife. Tucked into the bottom drawer of a writing desk, its hilt filigreed with Storm Scourge heather and engraved with the initials L.S. I hold it in my hands, feeling their trembling, as it occurs to me that possibly it was this knife that was holstered in Leon's boot as he knelt beside me that day. And then I force my hands still. The sun has set. Griff will be at the dunes in hours. I take the amphora and knife back with me to the cloister. and prepare for our last meeting.
31. The Driftless Dunes. Griff. The night I'm supposed to meet Antigone, I'm summoned to the chambers of Princess Freyda. She's being accommodated in a wing of the Provisional Palace that survived, undamaged, during the Kallipolan airstrike. The fire in her hearth is blazing, the room overwarm. I make full obeisance, palms and knees to the floor, and she tells her servants to leave us. I'm alone in a room with a God King's daughter. The only sound I can hear is her breath and mine. The only thing I dare look at are my own grimy nails. Is it true? She asks in her gently accented dragon tongue. That your dragon sparked first in the Pythian fleet? Aye, Your Highness. How unnatural. I study my hands, waiting. The sounds of a drink being poured, being sipped. And that you serve as Ixion's squire? Aye, Your Highness. Would you say that Ixion makes a good master? Where is she going with this? A hard one sometimes, but many masters are. Would he make a good husband? I exhale slowly. Speak freely, she commands. I have no reason to risk truth with this woman. No reason to respect her. No reason to like her. I'm fairly certain that I am, to her, little more than a dog. But in this one matter, I'll not lie. There are some kinds of decency that dogs and hostile queens alike deserve. He enjoys hurting people, Your Highness. The cup settles on its saucer. Thank you. That will be all. I rise to my feet, about to back from the room, when Freyda holds a letter out, unsealed. There was an order issued by the Glass Hall earlier today. I'd like you to deliver it to the captain of the Citadel Guard. I take it and bow. At once, Your Highness. As I do with Ixion, I move to the inkstand where the seals and wax are kept. As slowly as I dare, I lay the letter flat and begin to fold it into thirds. It says, Humble assets have served their purpose. Remove at dawn. Maybe I should be surprised, but instead it feels like this is the order I've been waiting to see my whole life. I fold the letter and seal it. When I turn to make an exiting bow, my eyes catch on hers. Her face reveals nothing. Does she know I can read? Is this some kind of tip-off, an unlikely offer of help from the Basileian God-King's daughter to a serf? Or is she even crueler than Ixion to let me deliver my own arrest warrant? Or is she perverse enough to let me think she doesn't know I can read? But now's not the time to wonder. As soon as I'm out of her chambers, I break into a run.
Lee. Annie and I go together to the Driftless Dunes to wait for Griff, a fake muzzle and Alethea's amphora wrapped in a blanket and tucked in her saddlebag, along with kindling for a fire. When I ask if Power is coming too, Annie's lips form a line. No, she says. I don't think so. In the hollow between two dunes, on the windward side free of snow, we pile the logs and Ayla lights the fire. It's warm enough, this sheltered and close to the sea, for her to spark. Annie throws a blanket beside it on which we sit to wait, Ayla and Palor curled beside us, and Annie reaches absently to scratch Ayla behind her horns. Then she reaches into the saddlebag attached to Ayla's back. I have something for you. When she presses it into my hand, and I recognize it, I feel my throat closing. I found it in that room by the amphora. I want you to have it. You gave me my mum's necklace and I wanted to return the favor. That she can even pretend those are commensurate actions makes me feel ashamed. Her necklace belonged to a mother my family left to starve. This is the knife of the man who took everything from them. And then add to that all the ways in the past week and in the past months that I've failed her. Annie. She tilts my face up with the tips of her fingers. I know it's been hard for you since the duel. Since the orphanage. You've been so busy at not being him. And you've been so beautiful at not being him, Lee. Cutting off your roots every time it's been asked of you. I've watched you do it and watched you hurt. And I think you've done it enough. Her voice hardens. Her breath quickens. When you look at this knife, I want you to remember it belonged to a father who loved you. And I want you to remember that I was the one who gave it to you. She leans forward and removes the old knife from my boot. Her face is downturned, wisps of hair curtaining it. When my hands don't move, frozen, holding the knife that was my father's, she replaces it herself. I lean over, take her hands in my own, and hold them.
Griff. I land Sparker in the alley behind our home. The night is dark, but Sparker's darker. And when Argus steps out onto our back stoop and sees his towering silhouette, she lets out a shriek that I clamp a hand over. Aga, this is Sparker. Aga shrinks, but I take her hand and Sparker lowers his muzzled snout to sniff her palm. She stretches trembling fingers up to trace the bridge of his nose as his great amber eyes focus on her. His tail perks up in interest and bangs against the roof overhang, dislodging thatch. Behind us, the door starts to open, Garrett's shrill voice piping Sparker's name, but Aga yanks it shut again, keeping him inside. Why is Sparker here? Because it's time. Aga withdraws her hand from Sparker's snout and turns to me, sucking in her breath. Becca's and Garrett's protests come muffled through the door as they hammer on it. I need you to tell the other squires. It's over. They're coming for us at dawn. Aga puts her hand over her mouth. But if they're going to arrest you, you should run, she whispers. Get out! I've got a better plan than that. I'm smiling, and Aga's shoulders settle as she understands. Tell the squires I'll be back before sunrise with what we need. Tell them to wait for me. Also, there's one more thing I need from you. At my description, she runs inside. The little ones' awed faces press briefly against the crack of the door, before re-emerging and closing in on them again to muffled cries of disappointment. I stuff the bundle she gives me into Sparker's saddlebag and turn to embrace my sister. As we pull apart, I lay steepled fingers against her face to trace our clan sign as we would paint it in battle woad. Aga inhales. Nag, keep you. Sparker and I are halfway across Sailor's Folly when I hear the bugle behind me. The sound carries muffled across miles on the sea below. A search party. I've been missed.
Lee. Griff Garrison's massive storm scourge lands so hard in the sand, the ground shudders. He slides from its back, already talking. It's tonight. It has to happen tonight. Please, by the dragon, tell me you have it. Annie is on her feet. She holds out the amphora. I have it. How much for each? Annie looks at me. I answer without hesitation. It's powerful. It should be enough to divide doses among the fleet. Mix it in with their feed. Shrines bless you, Griff says, taking it. Antigone, Lee. You should know. The Basilean princess is there, in New Pythos, with her Goliathan. Annie frowns, but Goliathans are only claimed by male heirs. Griff just shakes his head, and Annie's eyes widen at the same time as we realize, not anymore. We have to go, Griff says. They're looking for me. We've got to go. Annie holds up the fake muzzle, her thumb flicking the latch. Her dragon tongue, I realize, is smoother than the last time I heard it, more comfortable from practice. Her accent is as I remember it, from years of classes I spent listening to her learn my mother tongue. Utterly beautiful. Not before we spring Sparker. Griff stares at the fake muzzle, stunned. Behind him, Sparker's wings flutter open and then fill the sky like great black sails, his horned tail lifting. Griff turns back to him. You ready? Sparker growls in pleasure. Ayla ripples forward, nimbly mounts on her haunches and takes the muzzle in her teeth. Fire glows and grows hotter, whiter, concentrated between her jaws. Sparker whimpers but holds still. Griff is breathing slowly through his mouth. Tell me if she's hurting him, Annie says. Her pupils have dilated as she rides the connection, her fists clenched in concentration. Griff's face is scrunched up with pain. He clutches at his jaw and speaks through gritted teeth. Just keep going. The metal begins to glow red. Ayla begins to gnaw on it, tugging as she applies heat. Sweat is beading on Griff's brow. He lets out a shout, and the muzzle breaks. Glowing metal thunks to the sand at their feet. Ayla sits back, her tail swishing in the sand. Sparker flexes his jaw just a little, testing it. And then he arches his back and yawns the slowest, widest yawn I've ever seen. His relief so apparent I can practically feel it. And Griff, who can feel it, starts to weep. Sparker lifts back his horned head, throws open his jaws, and bellows flames into the night sky. They pour forth like a column of fire. And for a moment, as the entire valley between the two dunes is lit, I can't help thinking, no wonder they muzzled this one. Annie, who must be thinking something similar, is laughing. Laughing as she wipes her eyes. And then, from the periphery of darkness, comes a new voice. That looked very satisfying. On the crest of the dune, silhouetted in darkness, three dragons have landed. Two Aurelians and a storm scourge. The voice that spoke was Ixion's.
Griff. For a moment, Sparker and I are frozen, looking up at them. Ixion and Rhode and Roxana, here. Which means my time's up. And then I remember what Sparker can do. And Ixion is within my grasp. I'm on my dragon's back. We are charging up the dune before there's room for a single second thought. We ram against him. Sparker and Nita roll through the sand. Flames burst from Sparker's jaws with all the fury that's been years in the stifling. I begin to slide, loose in the saddle without bootstraps. The ground rises up and slams against me. For a moment, I lie winded. I've fallen from Sparker's back. But Sparker continues his battle against Nita without my help. Light and the sounds of skirmishes flare from the valley between the dunes where we left Lee and Antigone, where Rhode and Roxana are bearing down on them. Ixion's pale face looms over me. A fist slams into my gut. He's out of the saddle too, come to finish me while Nita and Sparker scrabble in the sand like rabid dogs. I can feel, every time Sparker fires, the rush of power. And it takes nothing, nothing at all, to flow it into my fist and land that fist in Ixion's face. The last time we were firing like this, we had just sparked and Ixion was beneath us. But tonight no one is here to pull us off, and no muzzle will stop us. I've got him on his back. I'm pummeling again and again with a sound coming out of my own mouth like a dragon's roar. Ixion twists, panting, and I realize that he's reaching for his boot knife. I reach for my boot knife. And then it's shining in my fist, and my hand is over his neck, squeezing, and his fingers are scrabbling at my hand like crabs. 3 yards away, Sparker has pinned Nita to the ground, where his wings beat weakly against the sand, and Sparker's fangs are on Nita's jugular. I can taste Nita's blood in my own mouth, taste its sweetness. Sparker looks up at me, awaiting my command. Ixion's pupils are dilated and he blinks them, feeling his dragon's fear. He begins panting names. Becca! Gareth! Aga! Grandfather Grady! My grip on his neck loosens. My knife has frozen. They will drop every single one of them if we don't return with you to the Citadel. Ixion wrenches my slack hand from his neck and pushes me off him. Call them off, he pants, with a glance at Sparker and Nita and at the skirmishing Aurelians below. Come peacefully, and there won't be any need for that. But Sparker is frozen, waiting, salivating on Nita's blood. I force my head clear. No, not a dragon's instinct. I have to think. Sparker still wears his saddlebag, and its contents remain intact. Down in the valley, the amphora of Drachthenasia and the fake muzzle lie untouched in the sand, forgotten during our fighting. And it's still hours until dawn. Ixion knows I've been meeting Antigone. He knows we broke Sparker's muzzle, but he doesn't know the whole plan, or its alternatives. My time might be up, but the game isn't. I let the knife fall to the sand, click to Sparker to heal. He growls and slowly, reluctantly, eases off Nita. I can taste his disappointment in the back of my throat. No more, I tell him. Ixion lets out a snort of laughter. Like I said, he says, wiping blood from his nose and taking my boot knife up off the ground. Piece of peasant shit. He gets to his feet and lifts his voice. Leo? Annie? Your friend's done fighting. I'd stop too if you want what's good for him. Slowly the muffled sounds of skirmishing falter. I risk a look down at the valley. Annie is staring up at me from Ayla's back, her helmet yanked off, her eyes wide and frightened as Roxana struggles to right herself. Leo is disentangling from Rode, his dragon kicking at molten sand. Griff, Antigone says, pain in her voice. Thanks for all your help, I call down to her. Pity it didn't work out. Wish you could have met my sister. Ixion is mounting Nita with a snap of his mantle. No one cares about your sister, Garrison. Just shut up and get on the dragon. I shut up and get on the dragon. When my lords lift off, I follow them into the air. And on the side where Ixion can't see, I unhitch the saddlebag containing the bundle and let it fall to the sand.
Lee. The Aurelian I tussle with holds nothing back, and we don't either. I don't know him, but I know who he is. Rode Hay Aurelian, son of Rhadamanthus, heir apparent to New Pythos and triarch presumptive of the Triarchy in Exile. Which, in another world, would have meant that he outranked me. But now only means we are on opposite sides of a war. This time, when Palor's fire injures, blackness does not spread across my vision. No memories come unwanted. I only fire harder. Until I hear Ixion's voice echoing down the dunes, calling us off. Palo and I are half buried from scrabbling with Rode and his Aurelian, and blisters of melted sand, glowing as they turn to glass, radiate from our fight. Rode is coughing, his arm to his helmet, as he pulls back.
You blood traitor bastard!
Rage only makes me laugh at that. But then my laughter stops, because Griff is climbing onto his dragon, and Annie's voice is choking as she says his name. She says it like she's saying goodbye.
He'll be dropped, Rode tells me. His family will watch, and if he's lucky, that's all they'll do. He'll be dropped, and so will you, and so will she.
His Aurelian kicks off from the ground. They're shadows above us, silhouetted against the stars. And with a thunk, a saddlebag lands on the sand at Ayla's feet. As they dwindle against the northern horizon, Annie and I dismount. She kneels beside the bag and peels it open with shaking hands. At first, I don't understand what I see. Old fabrics, undyed, worn and patched and stained, that Annie holds in her hands, uncomprehending, until she lifts them and their shape becomes clear. A woman's fraying dress, a hair scarf. I stare at them in puzzlement. Those are, I nearly say peasant clothes and catch myself, working clothes. But I know by how Annie's shoulders vibrate that she heard the thing I didn't say. I still don't understand what's happening until she says, I haven't worn a dress like this in years.
Annie. It all comes together, the pieces clicking into place as I hold Griff's sister's dress. The amphora at my feet, Ayla at my side. A scarf to hide my hair. Griff didn't know I'd bring him a fake muzzle. He assumed I'd come back with him and break the muzzles of the squire's dragons myself, like he suggested so many weeks ago. And I still can. How many hours until dawn? Lee's struggling to catch up. You can't seriously be suggesting. It was on the table. Griff and I discussed it. This is mad. We should go back, get back up. There isn't time. And Holmes will hear the entire story of tonight as an ambush I walked into. The last thing he'll authorize is reinforcement. My mind is racing to what else needs to happen for this to work. I reach up to the First Rider medal pinned on my uniform, the bugle encircled by silver and gold, and tear it free. I press it into Lee's hand. I should be back before this is necessary, but if not, Power Sir Eater is acting fleet commander. I have a fleeting thought to the fight with Power that sent me fuming out the door, but that doesn't matter now. What matters is I trust Power to do this job, and that if all goes well, he won't need to. Lee pockets the medal without looking at it, nodding at the assignation as if he hardly hears it. His fingers are raking his hair. But how would you even find whoever you need over there? Wish you could have met my sister. I'll go to Clan Nag and ask for Aga Garris' daughter, Griff's sister. She'll be able to connect me with the squires. You don't speak Norish, Lee shouts. I start laughing then. This is how bad it's been, I realize. We've gone for weeks and months speaking so little to each other that Lee doesn't even know what classes I'm taking. And now, when we're finally talking, there's no time. I've been taking Norish at the Lyceum for months. Lee's mouth has closed. I need to change, I say. He stands rooted to the spot while I unclasp the neck of my flame suit. The winter air bites my exposed skin and I inhale. Lee rouses himself. It'll be warmer under Ayla's wing. He's right. She makes a cone of her wing under which the heat of her body and mine, trapped, makes it just warm enough that stripping is conceivable, though a draft stings my skin. But when Lee steps into the space where draft comes through, I'm warm enough. We've never undressed each other before, apart from that surreal bath before the funeral. We have always kissed, touched, and held each other clothed. But tonight, when he reaches trembling fingers to the clasps of my flame suit and begins to undo them, I don't stop him. I can hear and see and feel our breath as his fingers make their way down. For a moment, we face each other with the flame suit at my feet. Then he pulls the dress down over my shoulders. I turn my back to him so that he can tighten the laces behind. He holds the scarf out, and I take it. Wind it in my hands the way, years ago, my mother taught me. My fingers remember what my mind has forgotten. They twist the scarf over my hair and bind it at my nape in a single, swift motion. I flip it over my head and look up at Lee. He is frozen, looking down at me, his face in shadow in the darkness of Ayla's wing. How do I look? Like someone I was taught to ignore. My breath skips. Good, I whisper. He kisses me, so softly on the lips I barely feel it, only the shiver it leaves. His fingers reach up to tuck a stray strand of hair under the hem of my scarf. I could come with you, he murmurs. There are so many reasons why he couldn't, starting with the fact that he doesn't know a word of Norrish and doesn't have anything to wear beside a guardian's uniform. And most of all, that while my face might not be recognized by Lee's family under a peasant's scarf, Lee's would. But I hear the fear behind it and understand. The only reason Lee wants to come is that he's scared out of his mind for me. I think, I tell him, one of us should probably stick around to take care of Kallipolis. There's an assembly tomorrow that you need to lead. With you? No. That's not my path. This is my path. It feels brilliant and blinding and free. The clarity that comes with this realization. We'll set our sights on the stars together, but they're different stars. And we'll stand back to back. I lift up on tiptoe to kiss Lee on the cheek. Try not to make too much of a mess of things while I'm gone. Lee lets out a puff of breath. Come back before I do, he says. I swallow and nearly laugh as my eyes prickle. There are days' worth of things to tell him. Weeks and months needed to make up for lost time and unhealed hurts. But they will have to wait. Before you know it, I answer. Lee leans his forehead against mine, and though I could kiss him again, I don't. Forehead to forehead, I look into his face and memorize it. Before I turn away, Lee's lips brush against my ear. Raise them to the ground.
32. The People's Assembly. Griff. Ixion does not return with us to New Pythos. He peels off and doubles back once we are out of sight of the driftless dunes, and soon more dragons dot the horizon, following him in the direction of Kallipolis, streaking silently past us in the dark. I count them off and guess. What's Ixion doing with the bastards? Rhodes' laugh is swallowed by the night wind. Wouldn't you like to know? Back at the Citadel, Sparker is muzzled again, then chained to the floor of his stall so tightly he can barely lift his head. I can feel his fury all the way from the glass hall where I'm hauled. D'Lo is already there, seated in the center of the floor where, when I was questioned about Julia, he stood. The Kallipolan attack blew out the hall's great glass windows, and wind whistles between the slats boarding them. The sight of Antigone Sir Ayla's humbling of the Pythian throne room gives me courage for the half moment I have to take it in. Then the guard behind me shoves me to my knees. Eyes on the ground, I glance at the boots of the Dragonborn encircling us. Freyda and her long train are not present, but the Great Lord and the Triarchy in exile are, with Rhode and Roxana present from the younger generation. D'Lo's foot taps the ground nervously beside me. I look at that tapping boot and wonder, did you tell them? And then I wonder if I care. Griff has had quite the night, Rhode says. Electra Stormscourge's throaty voice is full of alarm. He didn't thwart. Oh no, says Rhode warmly. That's proceeding as we speak. Ixion rejoined Freyda and the bastards on the way. And luckily, it looks like this one didn't tell the usurpers anything useful. An impending death sentence makes me punchy. I told them loads of useful stuff, thank you very much. Rhode's voice rises. I'd stay silent, Griff, if you know what's good for you. D'Lo groans softly into his hands, and for his sake, I close my mouth. Rhode proceeds to recount the night I've had to the listening adults. I study my hands, listening to the sound of D'Lo's slow, even breathing beside me. Panic-giddy thoughts flash from Ixion and his mysterious plot proceeding as planned to this room my body is trapped in, the punishment I'm soon to be set. The pen? The drop? The flame? If they're feeling particularly vindictive, it will be all three. Did D'Lo betray me? I force myself to remember the bundle, dropping it, the way Antigone's eyes grew round as I told her goodbye. She'll come. When Rhode has finished his account, Rhadamanthus says, What I don't understand is how. How did Griff free his dragon? The humble dragons should be chained. Roxana gets to her feet, comes to my side, and slides a hand into the collar of my shirt. The chain of Sparker's key spills out. Probably with the help of this. The sound of metal clinks as the key is thrown on the floor. Ixion still has his, she says. That's a copy.
What on earth?
Electra Stormscourge murmurs, like she's witnessing something obscene.
D'Lo, says Rhode pleasantly, would you like to explain any of this?
I dare a glance upward. D'Lo's face is downturned, scrunched as he observes his knees. I gave Griff the key to his dragon.
You authorized his visits with the Kallipolan First Rider?
No. No, of course not. I didn't ask what he was doing with it. Electra's skepticism is shrill with surprise.
Why did you give it to him then?
D'Lo's voice is soft and shaking. If you can't see why I did it, he says, then I've no answer that will satisfy you. I lift my head to look at him. He looks back at me, and that's when I know. D'Lo didn't tell them anything. D'Lo stands by me, even now. I lower my head, wondering if it's possible for a body to contain such triumph or such love. Nestor gets to his feet, lifts an arm and points it at his son.
Everything you do,
and ever have done is a blight on your mother's memory and a shame to Skyfish House. Dilo's breathing is ragged beside me. Forgive me, father, he answers. Rode yawns and uncrosses his legs. Perhaps we can conclude this farce by confining cousin Dilo to his chambers and escorting Griff Garrison to the dungeon. Unless you'd rather we drop him now. Later, Rhadamanthus decides. Better to make a lesson of it. Next to me, Dilo lowers his face into his palms and lets out a dry sob. I listen to the sound and wish we were alone. Wish I could comfort him. Wish I could tell him that Antigone is coming, bringing Drakthanasia and a dragon to break the muzzles, and these fools don't even know it. But I'll keep Dilo safe. A mad smile, the smile of the damned, has overtaken my face. It's been an honor serving all of you, I tell them, as the guard pulls me to my feet and I make the deepest bow I've ever made. Get him out of here, says Lady Electra in disgust. The last thing I see of that room are Dilo's shuddering shoulders.
Annie. Ayla and I keep to the cloud cover, burrowing into the stratus as we cross the moonlit North Sea through the studded cast of Sailor's Folly. It's early morning, the sky still black, when New Pythos looms before us. Chris's maps, labelled by Griff on our first meeting, inform my landing on the darkest tip of the shore, in a cove under the arm of rock that reaches the lighthouse. It's as I hoped. A deserted shoreline, where Ayla can fold herself into the darkness of the jagged cliffs while I find the people I need. Don't be seen, I tell her. Ayla offers a disgruntled huff, then begins to track circles in a nesting spot with her tail curving behind her. The amphora, stuffed into a bag over my back, makes me stoop with its weight as I set off. Heart pounding so hard in the silent night, I feel I can hear it. I make my way up the coastline toward the cluster of shacks that I hope I've correctly estimated to be Clan Nag. Bits of light peep through shutters here and there. I make my way down the outer streets of Griff's village and stop a peasant I find warming himself at a hissing barrel fire. The Norish comes out stiffly, but the sounds of the language are close enough to Kalish to disguise my accent. Where can I find Aga Garris' daughter? 10 minutes later, I'm standing in an alleyway in front of a lean-to the size of a woodshed. Smoke rises from the chimney. Light filters through a crack in crooked shutters over the window. I knock, and a young woman opens the door. A child on her hip who's half asleep. The woman has Griff's round, stubborn face. Aga? I whisper. The woman's eyes widen. She brushes back the hair of the girl she's holding and whispers into her ear. Becca, I have a surprise for you. Becca twists to look at me.
Is that Antigone?
She asks sleepily. An unexpected lump rises in my throat as I nod.
Hi, Antigone, Becca says. I told Garrett you would come.
It's only now, looking into the sleepy face of Griff's niece, that I finally believe it. For this girl, I'm not the bitch commander. I'm Antigone, Sir Ayla. First rider of Kallipolis. I'm everything the revolution promised.
You were right. Where is Griff? Aga asks.
I swallow, shake my head. suddenly conscious of the presence of a child and the need to mask my words. A memory, an echo, of a childhood hearing coded phrases exchanged by adults who seemed so old and wise then. Who, I realize now, must have been little older than Aga and I. Brewing desperate defiance of their lords to make a better life for children like Becca, like me. And now, it's our turn. I tell Aga. He's with his lords. Aga inhales. Her fingers tighten on her daughter's nightshirt as a shudder goes through her. Then her expression stiffens. Come in, she says. She leans against the door to widen it, and I step over the threshold into her home. She closes the door after me and tells the room. She's here. 6 Norsians are crammed into her tiny front room, clustered around the candle stuck in the center of a table, and where there aren't chairs, they're seated on the floor. Between Griff's age and mine, men and women both, the same curly hair and olive skin and bright, piercing eyes. And all of them in flame suits. Their murmuring conversations fall silent as they all turn to look at me. Antigone, says Aga, meet the squires. Have you got it? One of them asks. Effortless dragon tongue, like Griff. I rotate the bag from my back and peel it open. I've got it.
Lee. I'm back to the cloister before sunrise. The palace is still, quiet, waiting. Soon, the assembly will bring citizens through the outer gates by the thousands, filing into the arena where we competed last summer in tournaments, here today for a different kind of ceremony. And on the other side of the North Sea, Annie is about to gamble her life on an amphora and a semester's worth of Norish. The guardians gather in the refectory, helping themselves to warm ale that will be today's breakfast. I sit with the people's paper spread in front of me, along with notes for the assembly address. Between the snow lowering the risk of attack and the assembly grounding many of the riders fit for duty, most of the corps are present at breakfast. Where is she? Power stands on the opposite side of my table with his usual glare. It's the first time since returning from the dunes that I remember Annie's injunction to name him acting fleet commander in case of emergency, and for the first time, I hesitate at her choice. But I'm done going against her behind her back. I pull the medal from my pocket and slide it across the scarred wood. She'll be back soon. For now, we're saying she's on patrol. But if it comes to it, you're acting fleet commander. Power's eyes widen and his voice lowers. He doesn't reach for the medal. You left her. She went. Her mission depends on speed and stealth. She didn't need my accompaniment. Power scoffs. Yeah, I bet she didn't. You don't know any Norish. I'm not sure what his point is, and I resist the urge to point out that I am also needed here for the assembly that is about to take place and which I am required, as protector designate, to invoke. Just take the badge. Power reaches for it like he's snatching spilled change. He stuffs it in the pocket of his ceremonial uniform. Lee, calls Deirdre from the table where she's sitting with a few Aurelian riders. Have you seen? Power and I answer together. She's on patrol. An hour later, I pull on my ceremonial uniform and make my way to the inner palace, to the protector's office, where Atreus Athanatos waits for me to escort him to the people's assembly. The protector's guard open the doors to his office, crimson mantles rustling, and Atreus smiles at me from across his oak desk. A small, twisted smile. It's the first time we've met since the Gold Advisory Council named me protector designate. And before that, since I burned down his house with him watching from the fence. His only company is General Holmes. There he is, says Holmes, lurching to his feet at the sight of me and emanating grim disapproval. Shall we? The three of us leave the office together, and at a turn in the corridors, Holmes's chief of staff approaches. General, I need to borrow you for a moment. Holmes follows Lucian Orthos away, leaving Atreus and me alone.
That I lived to see the day Leon's son escorted me to a people's assembly,
Atreus says. I'm sure Leon would have been surprised as well. After what has happened, it should feel strange to talk about my father, to exchange these kinds of words, calm and not quite friendly, almost like banter. But it doesn't. It feels as if what has happened between us until this moment is the past, and this is the future.
In a way,
Atreus says as we leave the inner palace together, making our way through the snow-covered palace gardens, the Protector's Guard filing in behind us.
And you will forgive me this observation, Lee, as it looks like observations are what I have left. This is the greatest proof of all that my system worked.
We're about to completely dismantle the metal system, I point out. Atreus smiles.
You are about to completely dismantle it, he corrects. What greater proof could there be that my guardians are the best of them all than that they want to reform the very system that gave them power?
I feel it briefly ruffling me like a warm breeze, that old pleasure at his approval. And today, because it doesn't matter, I let myself feel its warmth. We walk together down the main path of the gardens that ends in the gate through the outer wall to the arena, and part at the stairs that will take Atreus up to the palace box, and me down to the stone platform of the Eyrie. The snow has been shoveled, the flagstones cleared. Overhead, the cast of Pytho's Keep towers in a grey sky. The stands are filling. As I prepare to mount the Eyrie, where the Guardians will already be gathering, Miranda Hayne, Minister of Information, touches my arm. Lee, I'd like a word. I follow her into the nearest viewing box, used by our drill master in poor weather to watch from shelter. She closes the door behind her, but even so, the rumbling of the growing crowd vibrates under our feet. Lee, something's going on. I realize only now that Hayne looks disheveled, as if she spent the night awake. Someone, she says, has been collecting information for the Triarchy in exile. Newspapers, communications. They've been using the Island of the Dead as the drop-off point, handing it off to Pythian dragon riders at night. On the far side of Pytho's Keep, the Island of the Dead would be the closest site a dragon could land without easy sighting from the city. I struggle to grasp the significance of what she's saying. So that's how they knew the location to our granaries? Probably, but that's not even my biggest concern right now. Lee, I was lucky the report of the sighting ended up on my desk. The path to that island is gated. The only Kallipolans with keys to it are ministry officials. The only reason a drop-off was witnessed at all, ironically, is because of a construction order Antigone Sor Aela put in for a memorial to the Dragonborn killed on Palace Day. Hayne seems to realize, mid-grimace, what connection I might have to such a project, and rearranges her expression. The point is, this is happening from the inside, and I don't know who's doing it, which means the Order of the Black Clover must be much more pervasive than we thought. The Order of the... Hayne snaps fingers impatiently. It's a triarchist group. They've been more and less active in the years since the revolution. My department discourages discussion of them, even internally. You won't have heard them mentioned on your rounds. That explains who Richard Tyndale was working with last term, when he was trying to get me to take my family's side. But Tyndale isn't a ministry official. This Island of the Dead drop-off is being done by someone else. A cheer goes up outside, the crier's voice coming muffled through the glass. The crowd is growing impatient. Is there a reason why we need to get to the bottom of this now? Hayne nods, twisting a coil of her hair as she squints out the dusty window. I'm wondering if we shouldn't have the assembly. After weeks of being pushed this way and that by adults who want a little more or a little less than I'm willing to give, this sets my teeth on edge. This assembly is what the Kallipolan people want. This is what we've fought in the streets for. This is what's been denied them for years. A chance to have their voices heard regardless of who they were born or where they live or how they performed on a test. I weigh the odds, listening to the rumbling through the window. Is there any reason this assembly is a specific cause for concern? No, not exactly, but then I'm not calling it off. We can look into the Order of the Black Clover afterward. I've compromised enough. For this, I won't. Miranda lets out a puff of breath. All right, she says. We enter the arena to an explosion of noise. The ramparts are a shimmering display of revolutionary uniform, the Protector's Guard interspersed under the fluttering red and black banners of the revolutionary dragon breathing four circlets of fire. Miranda Hayne leaves me at the stairs to mount the palace box, where Atreus and the High Council are seated as they were during our tournaments last year. I make my way up the ramp to the jutting stone platform of the Eyrie. Only after I have stepped onto the Eyrie do I see what's missing. The other guardians aren't here. They should be. It's well past time for their arrival. Their presence was planned to be on foot rather than dragonback in a symbolic gesture that today we all stand on the ground. But I'm the only guardian present. The Eyrie is empty. They must be running late. All of them? And then I notice something else. Atop the arena ramparts bordering the inner palace, guards are disappearing down the stairs as if summoned by an alarm below. Whatever noise they might be making has been drowned out by that of the people in the stands. The crowd, cheering my entrance with screams of "The Revolution's Son," don't notice anything amiss. Nor does Atreus, who goes to the rail of the palace box and raises his voice. I present Lee Sor Pallor, Guardian of Kallipolis, and Protector Designate by choice of the Gold Advisory Council, whose right it is by revolutionary law to call a people's assembly. And then he takes a step back. I suck in a breath and tear my gaze from the ramparts and the empty benches of the Eyrie where the guardians should be. This is a moment I will live without distraction. I walk to the edge of the Eyrie, listen to the cheering of the crowd, and let it build in my blood. Yes, this is how it begins. I fill my lungs as Pallor does when he prepares to fire, and lift my voice. Men and women of Kallipolis, we come together today with a new hope for our nation, to enter a new era, a second revolution, where every Kallipolan, regardless of birth or test result, has equal voice in what happens to our great island, where every Kallipolan is equally deserving. The cheers begin. I let them grow till they fill the arena. There is nothing in the world so high as the thrill of this. After a lifetime of imagining triumph in the arena, I finally understand that this was the triumph we needed. Not in the air, on the ground. I lift an arm for silence. Today, the first task of our reinstated People's Assembly will be to deliberate on the role of the metals test and the metals system. Boos begin to swell from the class irons and class bronzes present. I raise an arm again. But
before we begin that referendum, I would like to bring you our good news. As soon as can be hoped, aid will come from across the sea, from allies who share our new purpose. Footsteps sound beside me on the empty stone. A hand clasps my shoulder. I turn. Ixion Suanita stands beside me on the eyrie. Like me, he is wearing ceremonial livery, his emblazoned with the black clover of the Triarchy in exile. I have not stood so close to him since before the revolution. His face is longer, smooth-shaven, an echo of Julia's and also our father's. His smile is full of an ice I do not remember from our childhoods. He speaks in a murmur. Dragons surround your guardian barracks and all entrances to the palace box. The gates to your dragon's nests have been shut. You cannot summon. While I stand frozen, slowly understanding, my friends surrounded by enemy dragons cut off from their own, Atreus and his entire government cornered in the palace box, and Ixion beside me, beaming. He adds, Duck sends his greetings. Duck! Ixion puts an arm around my shoulder like brothers reuniting. Cooperate, and none of them need to come to harm. Duck's alive? Hand still on my shoulder, Ixion turns his radiant smile toward the murmuring Kallipolan audience. Your request for aid has been answered, cousin, he proclaims in lightly accented Kalish. Above us, the shadow of Pytho's keep moves. Wings unfurl from behind it like sails. A dragon unfolds from the cast and launches into the sky, casting a great shadow overhead. A dragon that has been lying in wait on the far side of the cast for this moment. A dragon the size of a warship. A Goliathan. I have come with an offer of generosity from our long-lost ally, Basilia, Ixion proclaims. Even now, ships are bound from the Basilean coast, courtesy of the beneficent Princess Freda, heir presumptive to the Basilean Empire, laden with grain for the starving Kallipolan people. We have Lysor Palor, the revolution's son, to thank for brokering this deal. His arm rises, gesturing upward toward the shadow of the great dragon circling overhead, and on it the dwarfed figure of a woman shining in her armor. Princess Freda brings the first installment today! Strapped to the side of the Goliathan is a bag the size of a horse. The armored princess looses the satchel and it plummets to thunk and burst open on the eyrie beside Ixion and me. Bread spills from it. Ixion bends down, picks up a loaf, and lobs it. The bread arcs slowly through the air and into the stands, into the hands of a citizen raised to catch it. Slowly, the murmuring of the crowd transforms, rumbling, low, and then rising as it sweeps the citizenry. Cheering. And all the while, with my cousin's arm on my shoulder, the thoughts pulse in rotation. Guardians surrounded in the cloister, the palace box cut off, the gate to the nests closed. Duck. Freezing my limbs in place, though my heart is pounding. Ixion lets the chanting continue until the sound of the people's cheering echoes within the stone walls. And then he raises his arm, silence falls, and he speaks again, his eyes blazing, and his smile widening. The full extent of Freda's aid will arrive on Kallipolan shores within the day, Ixion says. The Basileian's only price is the execution of the usurper, the arrest of those who stand with him, punishment for the injustices the new regime has committed in the name of revolution, and a reinstatement of Kallipolis's rightful rulers.
Silence falls. Ixion Sunita looks upon the assembly and smiles.
Shall we put it to a vote?
33. Prisoners and their guard. Griff. The citadel dungeon smells like piss and decay. My cell has no window, and the only light comes from the barred window in the door, looking out to the empty corridor. When food is brought to me, I'm surprised to see it's brought by a young woman, not one of the guards. Her hair is long, lank, unkempt, mostly shielding her face. But when, for a fleeting moment, the light reveals her profile, I recognize it. Mabelena? She pauses, her hand on the bowl of porridge, then pushes it the rest of the way through. I haven't seen her since the day, years ago, when they dropped her family, and then her. But before that, we were friends. Mabelena, please, tell me, have you heard anything? For a moment, she just looks at me, and then she sets a second bowl beside mine. On the other side of my cell, a shadow I hadn't even noticed moves. The figure rises, takes the bread and water from her, and speaks in heavily accented dragon tongue. Thank you, Lena. My vision adjusting in the darkness, I squint at my cellmate. A badly burn-scarred face beneath a growth of wavy hair looks back at me. And then I place that voice. Duck? The boy smiles, like I've just issued a dare. Griff Garrison, he answers. To be continued.
This is Christian Coulson. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Flamefall by Rosaria Munda. This program was directed by Alan Tobin, executive producer Nick Martorelli, edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2021 by Rosaria Munda. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.